In the news.
I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
Well, you lucky devils, you're with us for the second summer session, and today we're going to do our first In the News segment. You hopefully have read the syllabus at this point and have a sense of what the In the News segments are. What we're trying to do here is to talk about, you know, some range of events that have occurred in the last couple of days or so, and relate them to core concepts that you're going to be experiencing through the lecture modules and the web text readings and things like that. In other words, you know, we're not interested in just doing current events, but we're interested in trying to give you something more than, you know, here's what's on the, you know, on the headline ticker on CNN or Headline News or something like that, right? So hopefully one of the pieces of, one of the value points that we can add to your experience here at the University of Texas is not just kind of acquaint you with basic concepts of government, but try to help you draw connections between those concepts, whether it's federalism or checks and balances or party dynamics, to draw connections between those concepts and what you're seeing in the news, right? And so this is our explicit attempt to do that, right? So we'll talk a little more about some of the logistics, which you know, are already on your syllabus and everything, but we'll reiterate those at the end of our segment today. And the segments will run between 20 minutes and 40 minutes, depending upon how much energy we have and how much is in the news. Sometimes in the summer, it's kind of slow, not so much these days. So we're going to hit five topics today. Not quite lightning round. We're never quite lightning round material here. But two national topics we want to talk about, party politics and the sort of squad, as it's being referred to by the media, the four progressive freshman congresswomen in the House of Representatives and how they're kind of shaking up Washington. Second national topic, immigration policies and the ICE raids from this last weekend. And then three Texas politics topics real quickly. Third parties in the state of Texas, a movement to end judicial elections, which seems to be picking up steam. And then kind of interesting piece by Ross Ramsey in the Texas Tribune about what to actually watch for in the 2020 elections in the state of Texas. And here's a spoiler alert, it's not the presidential, it's actually the state house races. So with that, let's start at the top, let's start national and kind of work our way down. This last weekend, actually late last week and then across the course of the weekend, there was a lot of conversation in Washington about the four Democratic female freshmen, all women of color, who have been attracting a lot of attention, kind of aggressively using social media to promote a progressive liberal agenda. So I'm talking here about Ocasio-Cortez from New York, Omar from Minnesota, Presley from Massachusetts, and Taib from Michigan. So these are the four women, all of whom have you know, Ocasio-Cortez is obviously Hispanic or Latina. Omar is Somali background, first generation. Presley, a woman of color from Massachusetts, and then Tlaib. I think what's Tlaib's background? I can't even recall whether she's second generation. She's not born outside the United States, but Lebanese, I think.
Yeah,
I think Lebanese, right. So, you know, what are we talking about with respect to controversy? Well, they got into a little bit of a dust-up with their own party last week. There was a compromise bill, emergency funding for the facilities down on the border, and Nancy Pelosi and the other Democrats had cobbled together a piece of legislation. They'd gotten fairly significant support across the board. Some Republicans, but almost all the Democrats voted for this appropriations bill that was going to increase funding, emergency funding for facilities down on the border because of the crisis there in terms of accommodations. And these four Democrats voted against the bill. And Pelosi, you know, they had tweeted out that, you know, this isn't going to do anything. This is a bad bill. It just helps Trump. And, you know, these facilities are concentration camps and a lot of the rhetoric they'd been using. And Pelosi was asked about their votes and their posture towards the legislation. And she said, you know, basically, as you might expect someone of her generation to say, said, this social media and tweeting, I don't care about that. Bottom line is they got four votes. And that's all I care about. The squad, as these four women have been kind of dubbed by the media, responded on Twitter saying, you know, well, she doesn't understand this. In fact, kind of implying that, in fact, the chief of staff of one of them, I can't remember which one, but the chief of staff basically accused Pelosi of being an old, out-of-touch racist. Now, as you might imagine, Nancy Pelosi, who's the Speaker of the House, wasn't terribly thrilled by this assertion. And so Pelosi had a closed-door meeting where, according to accounts, she basically told not just the four, she told everybody in the Democratic caucus, hey, you got a problem, come to me. Don't go on Twitter. Don't take it to the media. So it's interesting. There are some people who are arguing that the problem that Pelosi is having with the progressive wing of her party is like the problem that John Boehner and Paul Ryan, the Republicans who were speakers prior to Pelosi, had with the right wing of the Republican Party. And that was basically those two couldn't manage the conservative Republicans. Interesting question now is, can Pelosi manage the liberal or progressive wing of the Democratic Party? That's the big picture. But there's an interesting smaller picture, which is, how do you treat, you know, people who are traditionally disadvantaged, traditionally discriminated against, who rise to power? What sort of language is appropriate as you're addressing them and trying to make them do what you want to do in party terms? And all of that came out. Layered on top of that was 2 days ago, Donald Trump responding to some tweets that he thought were derogatory towards the United States by the squad, basically said, you all need to go back where you came from and fix your own countries before you come to the United States. That didn't go over well with pretty much anybody. So, Professor McDaniel, as a person of color, your reaction to this? And
as I speak for all people of color.
That's exactly right. I like to think I speak for all old white guys. It's a constituency near and dear to all of our hearts.
And I guess also as a scholar of racial ethnic politics, we should not be surprised by this. There's what you're seeing out of, I guess, the group we call the Squad is rumblings you've seen within the Democratic Party for long periods of time, where the establishment is calling for kind of incremental change, where these other groups say, look, we represent groups that have been disadvantaged and marginalized. And so if you think about them, I mean, they're disadvantaged racially, they're disadvantaged because of their gender, but also some of them are disadvantaged because of their religion. And so what you have here is a group of people who want, who don't see incrementalism as helping them at all. So in many ways, if you think of King's letter from the Birmingham jail, where he talks about, people talk about, no, wait, give it time. It's like, well, no, we can't wait anymore. And so for them, there's a very strong sense of urgency. Now, I'm not trying to compare them to Martin Luther King or anything like that, but if you can think about the language he used, there's a strong sense of urgency. But there's also been this belief, specifically amongst people of color, specifically amongst blacks in the Democratic Party, is that, you know, blacks have been used really as the cannon fodder of the Democratic Party, where the Democratic Party will use blacks for their votes, but then will kind of forget about them as things move on. And I think a lot of this is coming forward with what we're seeing happen with Joe Biden, where people are basically bringing up a lot of things that he did in the past, which undercut black interest, with busing being an example, the crime bill being another example, but then trying to appeal to black voters, like, hey, you need me. So you have this argument about, you know, what you see as incrementalism, we see as continued oppression. And so this becomes problematic. But another part of this is, again, if you think of the 60s where protests were a way of making things public, you're seeing these things happen now with Twitter. And again, I'm not trying to say they're like King or the new civil rights movement, but you can see some of the similar tactics. But one of the problems with going public is that it creates all kinds of problems, in the sense that you will make statements that are to try to get people's attention that you may not want to make. And what you see coming on with Speaker Pelosi is she's making very strong, like, look, we're going to handle this in-house. If you have a problem, come to me, talk to me. Now, it could be an argument where they feel like she's ignoring them. And because you're ignoring us, we have to go public. You know, I do believe that they are tapping into something that you see with a lot of, given the way the Democratic Party is set up, given the nature of the leadership of the Democratic Party, which has for the most part been white male, now more white female, but still upper class whites, you're feeling this sense of, like, no, we have to make sure this party is responsive to our needs. And so you can think of individuals like Donna Brazile, a bunch of others who made this kind of demand against the Democratic Party of, you know, take us seriously. And so that's part of it. But the way in which they're doing it, they're going public, be truthful, that's kind of how they got to where they are. They used social media to try to get the word out, to get people to pay attention to them. I really think as time goes on and they gain a little bit more power in the House, that's going to calm down. Because right now, they're on the outside banging on the door to get power within their party. And this is their way of doing it. I think once they get in, you might see them calm down a bit. The rhetoric's going to calm down a bit because now they're part of the establishment. Right now, they're freshmen. They don't have much going on. They're coming in. They're demanding change. But I think once they actually get a little bit of power, you will see that language curtail. But the last thing that's important to note is that given the racial context that we have within the U.S. right now, is that things are very, very heated and very passionate. And so they are playing. So I think part of this, they're feeling it, but also they're playing into it. And in many cases, the fear is that a lot of what they're doing is reactionary, not fully thought out. So much as people criticize the Tea Party as being reactionary to Obama, you could argue that they're being reactionary to President Trump. I think a lot of this needs to be worked on. But what it's really demonstrating is something that's been brewing with the Democratic Party for a long time. This is not something new. It's been brewing for a long period of time where you find that marginalized communities, which the Democratic Party says, oh, we represent you, are feeling like, no, we feel like we're just being used as your cannon fodder. You're using us to get votes, but you're not being responsive to us. Whereas the squad, you could argue, is calling the party out, saying, no, you will be responsive. You will do right by these people. Incrementalism is great for people who are in power and are in the status quo. It's horrible for the marginalized. And so, again, that's part of it. But then also part of it is again, using social media. It's the tactics that are being used. So the argument, you have the argument, but then you also have the tactics, and it's the combination of these two which can lead to large numbers of problems. However, with President Trump's response, that's actually, in some ways, maybe galvanized them a little bit, because President Trump went out, and it was a very strong attack that he put towards them, and so now we need to protect them. And in many ways, some have argued that President Trump may be attacking them on purpose so they can rise in power to make the Democratic Party look even more radical than it actually is. I'm not sure if he's that strategic. I think he's known for basically just lashing out at anybody who critiques him. But I think what he's done is he may be solidifying their roles and helping them gain power through these types of attacks, because the Democratic Party now has to protect their own. Even though they may not be happy with the way they're doing things, they now have to protect them. And so I really think, as time goes on, you give them like one or two more terms, a lot of that language will calm down, especially as they gain power. But we're going to see how this plays out. But again, we're also going to see how this plays out in the primaries, because I think the primaries are where you're going to really see a lot of these concerns come forward. Where, again, the history of the Democratic Party in terms of ignoring the interests of the marginalized, I think Joe Biden is going to be the target of all of that, because, again, he represents the old school Democratic Party. And so he will be the target of those criticisms.
Yeah. Now, this is, Professor McDaniel does a lot of work on race and politics and public policy, but he also does some electoral politics. I do very limited work on race and ethnicity, a little bit of work on coalitional politics. But for me, let's do a couple things real briefly and let's move on. I want to make three points. First, for everybody out there, let's make sure we're explicit. When we're talking about the squad, we're talking about four Democratic congresswomen, each of whom was elected in 2018. Ocasio-Cortez from New York, Omar from Minnesota, Presley from Massachusetts, and Tlaib, T-L-A-I-B, from Michigan. That's the squad. The three points I wanted to make, first of all, referent to what we're going to be doing in the first couple weeks, the first module of the course. It's really interesting. They represent districts, smallish, just all districts are smallish. I'm not comparing them. They're all the same size. But they represent, a narrow slice of the world. And so when Ocasio-Cortez or Omar takes a very strong progressive position, your first reaction might be, wow, that seems kind of extreme. Well, not given where they're representing. So Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, representing a constituency in Brooklyn. Brooklyn or the Bronx? I think Brooklyn.
Bronx.
Bronx, sorry. it's heavily, you know, racial and ethnic minority, very progressive in their attitudes. So when she takes a strong position on questions of race, she's not, it's not an extreme position given the constituency she is representing. And that's a feature of having 435 districts. Some of them are going to be diehard conservatives, some of them are going to be ultra-liberal, and the people who represent those districts have an interest in adjusting their public policy positions to most effectively represent that district. So these four individuals don't particularly care about taking positions that are out of step with the National Democratic Party. In some ways, they don't care about the National Democratic Party, right? They're representing their constituents. Second point, coalitional tensions. Having said that they don't really care about the National Party, I overstated that a little bit. They do want to push the party further left. And as freshman congresswomen, you know, days gone by, you didn't have much of an opportunity to do that. The national media wasn't going to cover you if you're a freshman, you know, from the Bronx, unless you've got 10 million Twitter followers. And that, as Professor McDaniel, I think, aptly pointed out, that's the difference these days, right? And by the way, I would argue this, they're of the same piece of Donald Trump. Donald Trump was a reality TV star. Why did we pay so much attention to him in 2015 and 2016? Because network television decided he was really good for ratings. He was entertaining, right? And so they covered him disproportionately, you know, compared to his experience and obvious, you know, kind of qualifications for the position of the presidency. That's clearly going on the left, right? I mean, why should we be paying more attention to Ocasio-Cortez than we should Nancy Pelosi? Well, the reality is we shouldn't, except Ocasio-Cortez is much more interesting and entertaining than Nancy Pelosi is. So the Professor McDaniel mentioned going public. Twitter gives these kind of lower level representatives an opportunity to speak to a much broader audience than they would have been able to access 10 or 12 years ago, where the media in those days served as a gatekeeper. And, you know, they wouldn't put your stuff on the front page of the New York Times. Well, now the squad doesn't have to worry about what reporters at the New York Times think is newsworthy. They create their own following, and then the New York Times comes along because the New York Times wants to plug into that audience. So it's a different dynamic. So that's it. So constituents and districts, coalitional tension plus, you know, an attempt to represent a kind of a new vision for the Democratic Party plus social media is my second point. Third point is I find this interesting in terms of the role of parties in Congress. Given the first two dynamics, a bunch of free agents representing constituents with their own idea where the party should go, how does Nancy Pelosi or any leader in Congress herd the cats? And what kind of sticks and carrots, to use the metaphor, does Nancy Pelosi have to induce collective behavior to get legislation through? And that's tough. She can chide them. She can try to give them or not give them committee assignments. She can try to, you know, influence, if she really doesn't like them, people to run against them in primaries. But there's a limited array of tools, especially when you're dealing with when you're dealing with members who are basically in very safe Democratic districts. What do you do? I mean, how do you threaten them? How does Pelosi get, you know, Ocasio-Cortez to go along with legislation that Ocasio-Cortez doesn't really like? Limited tools. All right, so anyway, those are the three big points I wanted to mention. Let's move, you know, having spent 20 minutes on one topic, let's move to immigration, politics, and ICE raids. And I'll kick this off by saying, I don't have a lot to say here. I want to make two points, one serious, one facetious. The serious point is, I would just like you all to look at the immigration crisis as a very interesting exercise in federalism. That is to say, the state of Texas has a role, obviously, in border enforcement. But so does the federal government. And ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, they're charged with protecting the border. That's a federal organization. And one of the things you guys have probably heard about if you're listening to this or watching this story play out is a lot of places, Austin, for instance, other cities, are sanctuary cities. That is, they're not going to they've said they're not going to cooperate fully with ICE. And this represents, I mentioned federalism. In the case of sanctuary cities, it's a city versus federal tension, but you also see city versus state tension, state versus federal government tension. Immigration is where a lot of those issues, and if you're scratching your head at home thinking, I don't quite understand who's in charge of what, welcome to the club. It's not clear who's in charge of what. And that's kind of one of the things that Professor McDaniel and I want to emphasize. So that's my serious point. My facetious point is, why do they keep announcing these raids. You know, if the raids, by the way, if you weren't paying attention, last weekend the Trump administration said that we are going to go after people who we know are in the country illegally, and you know, where we have a good sense of where they are. We're going to go out. These are people who've ignored orders to leave or orders to report to deportation hearings and things like that. We know where they are. We're going to go after them Sunday at 6 a.m. I just don't understand why you announce that. It strikes me that, you know, if I'm at home and I'm, you know, I've missed my deportation hearings and I know they're coming at 6, then I'm either not there or I'm certainly not answering the door. But anyway, I'm not a public policy guy, so Professor McDaniel, you'd educate me on this.
I think one of the things about making these announcements is getting the base riled up, like, oh, he's going to take action on this.
Another, so Trump appealing to the Republican base and yeah. conservatives. Yeah, I think that's.
I think another aspect of it may be, and so it may just be more symbolic in the sense that you're not going to do it, but you want to make it look like it's like you're going to do something about this. From the other standpoint, one of the concerns that people have, specifically those who, again, let's make it very clear. I don't think there are very few people who are actually in favor of open borders. They do believe that people, you know, if they enter the U.S., should enter the U.S. legally, that there are some standards that must be met. And then if it's time to go, it's time for you to go. I think there are very few people who say, oh, I'll just leave it open for everybody. Now, I know there's been some discussion of decriminalizing. And that's a little bit different. Decriminalizing isn't making it legal. It's basically saying, fine, we're just not going to punish for this. Just like decriminalizing marijuana, meaning that it's not legal to sell it. We're not saying it's legal to smoke it, but if we catch you on it, we're not going to prosecute you on it. I think one of the concerns you have from a lot of individuals who do want some immigration reform, but want to make sure that there is some level of justice in this, is the fear that what you're doing is you're creating communities which will automatically feel a sense of fear of working with the government. And so that if a crisis does come about, they will be too scared to work with the government. That their understanding of the government will be that this is an oppressive system and will not want to work with the government. And what we know is these individuals, you know, even if they are U.S. citizens, will be less likely to vote, less likely to seek help from the government, and so in many ways will shut themselves off. You'll see this community shut themselves off. And so that is one of the concerns on the other side. But again, there is this broader concern of what do we do about controlling who is in the U.S., specifically those who are undocumented. The Obama administration did a large number of deportations. And, you know, one of the criticisms of the Obama administration is that, you know, he was seen as kind of the deporter in chief. It wasn't as announced, it wasn't as public. But there's also concern about, they said about 2 to 3% of the people who were deported were actually U.S. citizens. And so if you're doing, you know, several hundred thousand deportations a year, you know, that's several thousand, you know, Americans who are being deported even though they shouldn't have been deported. And another concern has been that given the status of undocumented immigrants in terms of residency, things of that, they may have been told they need to show up for something but never received it. Or they've been told to show up because they don't trust the government, they don't show up. It's all kinds of confusion here. I'm not really sure what all substantively will be accomplished by doing this. But it's something we'll have to see going forward, because symbolically it looks great, it energizes the base. Substantively, I'm not sure how this will actually play out and what the true outcome of this will be.
All right, so let's move to some state stuff. We're gonna hit third parties, judicial elections, and 2020. All right, so, and all due credit to the Texas Tribune, Professor McDaniel and I were kind of scoping out topics for today's In the News segment, and there's some really interesting stuff on the Texas Tribune, and UT has a relationship with the Texas Tribune. We we do a polling project with them, and they have some really terrific reporters over there. In fact, the Trib has kind of become a model for news media coverage of state politics across the country. There are other kind of copycats for the Texas Tribune. But there are a couple articles we thought were interesting. The first was third parties sue to get on the ballot in Texas. And I just wanted to make sure I got this correct, because currently, Professor McDaniel and I were kind of wondering, we want to make sure we got the current law correct. So you may, if you guys haven't voted, please, you know, in this next cycle, make sure you go out and vote. But you'll notice, I think it's always curious, Why does the state of Texas have to pay for, you know, primary election ballots? And how is it that the political parties get to dominate ballot access the way they do? And I had a professor when I was an undergraduate at UCLA who used the following analogy. He said, parties are like public utilities. The Democrats and Republicans agree to some regulations and some limits on what they do in exchange for the state basically kind of keeping other parties down a little bit, right? So campaign finance regulation, election regulations, the Republicans and Democrats agree to a lot of that stuff because in exchange, the state agrees to give them primacy on the ballot instead of the Libertarians or the Green Party. So this suit that the Texas Tribune talks about was filed jointly by the Libertarian Party, which is it's basically born of an ideology that says, I don't want the government doing much economically. I don't want them regulating and taking a lot of my tax dollars. I also don't want the government doing a lot socially. I don't want them regulating my sexual behavior or morals or things like that. So Libertarian is kind of out of my bedroom and out of my pocketbook, right? The Green Party is, as you might kind of glean from the name, very, very focused on environmental issues, on what we call post-materialist issues, issues of women's rights, issues of progressive party politics and things like that. So they're kind of strange bedfellows in that sense, but they both agree that the Republicans and Democrats are kind of working, colluding against them. All right, so what is the current law? In the lawsuit filed Thursday in Austin, plaintiffs argued that the current state law would give non-major political parties in 2020, so that's the Libertarians and the Greens, just 75 days to obtain over 80,000 valid signatures in order to obtain ballot access. And they estimate that the cost of meeting this threshold would be about $600,000 in order to organize and to actually get this kind of process going successfully. Now, what is it that we do in Texas? Well, in Texas, what we do is we wait. We say you don't qualify for the ballot unless you receive 5% in the previous election cycle. So if you're a Libertarian candidate and you got 5% in the governor's race, then your candidate in the next election cycle, in this case that'd be 2022, would qualify. But if you didn't get 5%, you have to meet these ballot thresholds, right? So you'd need to collect, again, it looks like 80,000 valid signatures. Now the 80,000 valid signatures have to be registered voters, and they have to be registered voters who did not participate in the Republican or Democratic primary. All right, that's kind of a sore loser law. What they want to do is they say, well, you can't have people who voted in the Republican and Democratic primary who are mad, and then they turn to get their Green Party or Libertarian candidate on the ballot. So it's sort of an effort to prevent sore losers, all right, if you follow me on that. But it presents an enormous burden, right? You're basically saying anybody who voted in the primaries can't sign one of these petitions, but you still have to be a registered voter. All right, so it's registered kind of non-primary participants, and you need 80,000 of them. And there are estimates that it's burdensome beyond what is acceptable. Now, Professor McDaniel and I were asking before class, like, well, what exactly is the legal claim, though? I mean, it's hard is not a legal claim, right? It's unfair is not a legal claim, something we would encourage you to remember when with respect to grades in this class. What's the actual constitutional claim? Well, we found they said that the plaintiffs argued that the election code violates their First Amendment, presumably free speech, yeah, I guess, free speech, and 14th Amendment rights. Now, the 14th Amendment is one of the Civil War amendments that talks about due process under law and equal protection. And they said it did so by, this is the quote, by imposing discriminatory and severely burdensome requirements on independent candidates and minor political parties that seek access to Texas's general election ballot, unquote. Okay. I'm not sure I really get the specifics of that constitutional claim, but that's the claim anyway. All right. So, lawsuit out there. Now, one thing that was interesting is Professor McDaniel and I were looking at this. One thing that's going to kick in, there's already a law that was passed in the last cycle that's going to kick in 2020 that, as I mentioned, to qualify for the ballot, they said currently the law says you had to have gotten 5% in the previous election to automatically get a space on the ballot next time around as a party. They're going to lower that to 2%, so from 5% to 2%, and in any one of the last five general elections. So if your party got 2% in that race in any of the last five elections, you're automatically on the ballot. So in some ways, I'm not quite sure what this lawsuit's about. It sounds like they've already passed a law. It kind of gets them a long way there. Anyway, so we wanted you to be aware of that. You got anything on that, Professor McDaniel, or do we move to judicial elections?
I think a lot of this will become a better context when we get to the next module where we talk about parties, and particularly discussion of third parties and the problems third parties have with state ballot access and how the laws are set up to undercut third party success. But, you know, to me, this is an interesting issue, and I think it'll become even clearer when we talk about parties.
Right. I mean, for the first module, the only thing I'd point to is these interesting claims, the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment claim about, you know, that they think is the basis by which you would rule Texas's election law unconstitutional. That's a, I don't know, you know, it's, I'm not prejudiced in the sense that I have a dog in this hunt, but I don't know that I really understand that claim fully. Let's just put it that way.
The logic needs to be spelled out.
That's a tricky one. Okay, so speaking of the judiciary, another kind of interesting development here, and again, I'm going to the Trib here. After a punishing election for Republican judges, state leaders are set to take a long look at Texas's oft-criticized judicial selection system. Now, this is something we'll cover in one of the later modules when we do institutions, but it's something we might as well preview this right now. A partisan election structure that Texas Supreme Court Chief Justice Nathan Hecht has described as, quote, amongst the very worst methods of judicial selection. So this is a theme we'll talk about a lot this semester. Texas does things in different ways. And, you know, with respect to the structure of the executive branch, with respect to the way the legislature is structured, so, you know, we only meet every other year for a limited amount of time. Legislators don't get very much money. But judicial elections is certainly a target amongst or for those who want to reform the Texas system. What's interesting here is that Republicans really began their period of ascendancy in 1994 is kind of the key date here, when Republicans have not lost a statewide election in Texas since 1994. Right? That's a long time now. And they began their ascendancy by winning judicial elections. Texas has historically been a very Democratic state. But Republicans began winning judicial elections in the 80s and into the 90s. What's interesting now is that Democrats have begun winning some of these judicial elections, especially in Harris County and in Dallas County. And there's some thought, like, for instance, another sort of money paragraph here. It says, after a punishing election for Republican judges, this summer Greg Abbott signed a law creating a commission to study the issue, signaling that the GOP-led legislature, GOP's grand old party, the Republican Party, could overhaul the system as soon as 2021. That move comes after Democrats killed a sweeping proposal, reform proposal, that Abbott had quietly backed. So it's interesting in partisan terms, Democrats, you know, what we're talking about here is judicial appointments rather than judicial elections. Republicans were fine with elections when they were winning all the elections. Perhaps now there's a partisan incentive for Republicans to prefer statewide officials appoint judges as opposed to elections, because the Democrats are beginning to winning in some places, especially in the metro areas. I can't believe it.
Oh, of course. But I also think one of the things that this ties into is when you read about the Texas Constitution and what led to the creation of the Texas Constitution that we're under, is that in many cases this is a reaction to Reconstruction, and they really wanted a lot of the people to have a lot of control over the government. And this is why pretty much every office is a partisan open election. And so we have elected judges, you know, you think of the variety of aspects of the executive branch that are elected. In many cases, this is a reflection of the Texas Constitution and its reaction to Reconstruction. So Texas has been much maligned because of its process in terms of electing judges in partisan elections. And this has been a critique, and a lot of people have argued, like, no, we need to go to some type of merit selection process to maybe go for re-election. And this may be what we see take shape, but it's interesting to see this reform is not necessarily based upon the idea that you want competent individuals in office, but more that you don't want to lose your partisan influence. And one of the major critiques about the Texas system is, to what degree can you actually measure competency for someone to have a judicial appointment? And again, people weren't, as long as your party was winning, you didn't care about competency. But now that we, not your party's losing, it's like, oh, whoa, we got to make sure we have competent people there. Yeah, so it's the great thing about democracy.
Yeah, and again, to kind of loop it back to some of the points we're talking about in the first module, you notice in Texas that there's sharing of powers. That is, the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive branches share powers in the state. But unlike the federal governing structure, the explicit checks and balances that exist at the federal level are less present in Texas, right? So, instead of having, the executive appoint the judiciary is independently elected. Instead of the governor appointing sub-officials within the executive, they're independently elected. And I think it speaks to, remember, the Texas Constitution comes about a little under 100 years after the American Constitution, and, you know, Texans traditionally are suspicious of government. They want the people to be able to determine these things rather than, elected officials sort of checking each other. So it's kind of a time-honored tradition in Texas. Most people nationally think it's weird to have judges elected. And there's something I think even in Texas we think is a little unseemly about judges running for office and having to raise money to contest elections. So that's always been something that reformers have been irritated with. But partisans have been less irritated about that, especially if they're winning elections. So it's funny how when you start to slip in power a little bit, you become a good government advocate.
You change the rules when things aren't going your way.
Yeah. All right, last topic quickly. I just wanted to point out there was a nice article again in the Tribune by Ross Ramsey saying that, you know, there's a lot of focus with Julian Castro, with Beto O'Rourke, with obviously President Trump about the presidential election in Texas. We're going to have a primary in early March that a lot of the Democratic candidates are targeting as an important election for them. But Ramsey argues that the most interesting election in Texas is not going to be the presidential. It's not going to be the Cornyn versus MJ Hager or whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate. It's actually going to be the Texas State House. And Professor McDaniel and I were just looking at the numbers, and we're reminded that both the Texas House and Senate, especially the Texas House, they're not that Republican anymore. 150 members of the House currently, 83 Republicans, 67 Democrats. Now, with 150 members, not too hard to figure out, you need 76 for a flat-out majority. 76 for a flat-out majority. The Democrats are at 67, so they need to pick up nine seats. Nine seats in order to get where they need to go. There are a lot of changes in Texas, a lot of districts that are trending purple, maybe even blue. So Ramsey's point is that this could be really critical, especially with redistricting of the state of Texas looming after the 2020 census, right? That the legislature that is elected in 2020 is going to be in charge of drawing the lines for representation in Congress, in the State House, and in the State Senate subsequently. So the Democrats are really, really focused on trying to claw their way to 76 out of the 150 seats. And that's all I really had to say about that, but yeah. Thought it was interesting.
I mean, it's clear. I doubt that they'll get those nine wins. They might get three, which means they may have a little bit more influence within the state Senate. It's been 19 Republicans, 12 Democrats for a long time, and so I don't see that changing.
31 state senators.
Yeah.
Right now, 19 and 12, 19 Republicans, 12 Reps. And the state Senate districts are much larger, obviously. So it's a little harder to win districts in the Senate, and plus the Republicans drew the lines, than it is in the House.
Yeah, and it's also important to remember that not too far ago, the Republicans had a supermajority where they were over, they made up two-thirds of the House. But that's gone away very quickly. And so it'll be interesting to see how much progress the Democrats are able to make. It's even more important to know to what degree they'll be able to work together as a coalition, either as the minority party or the majority party. I remember having one state rep, talking to one state rep, and asking her, like, well, what exactly are the plans of the party? He's like, well, you know, one of the things we realized is that we need to work together. I was like, oh, you just realized that. So to me, I think that is really what's going to be core there. And I think they can pick up some seats. They have been making progress, But as far as getting the majority, not so much, but getting very close to it, I think is enough to where if there is any crack or fissures within the Republicans, they may be able to take advantage of it if they stay focused together. But as far as the Senate, I don't see any changes with the Senate, but they may be able to change the way things are operating in the House.
Right. Okay, so again, that'll wrap up our first in the news segment. A couple logistical things we wanted to emphasize. Hopefully you guys are all still with us on this, so pay attention. All of the in the news assignments are due at 5 o'clock on Monday, so next Monday, 5 o'clock Central Daylight Time, 5 o'clock PM Central Daylight Time. You'd be surprised how creative students are when saying, well, you didn't say daylight time or non-daylight time, or, you know, so I don't care if you're in Brussels or Shanghai or whatever, they're due 5 o'clock Central Daylight Time. So this is a great thing. You can take the class anywhere, you can take the exams anywhere, but when it comes to submissions, you know, don't tell us that, well, it's 2 a.m. where I am. Well, you know, if you're in Fiji, you know, on some sort of bungalow out overlooking the water, Professor McDaniel and I aren't really sympathetic to, well, it's 1 a.m. when I have to submit my, no, just submit it. That's part of it's the beauty of the course is you can do this anywhere. So make sure you hit your submission deadlines. Piece of advice, don't wait until 4:55 to turn it in. Because if you've got some sort of connectivity issue, any kind of glitch, then it will be a problem, and then you will be emailing us with a long-winded excuse, which we would prefer not to get at this stage of the summer. Follow the instructions and check your submissions. We cannot emphasize this enough, people. Canvas will tell you when you have successfully submitted. All right, so again, do it a little early, give yourself a little bit of leeway, and make sure you check and follow up. Now, there's a big green button that says submit. It's not rocket science, but you know, you still need to follow up, check, and make sure. All right, so that is your burden through this semester, is to make sure that on the technical side that you're meeting our specs and that you're doing things correctly. You know, we'll have people from time to time say like, oh, well, there's something wrong with the software or your system. You know, I had a professor, again, when I was at UCLA, and I used to write these, you know, computer statistical programs, and I'd go and say, you know, there's something wrong with the computing system. It's just not doing this. And he'd say, look, 99 times out of 100, it's your fault. And I'd say, yeah, you're wrong. And it almost always was. All right, so it could be, but the default, almost certain explanation is you did something wrong. So follow the instructions and protect yourself. All right, if you're a student who has an accommodation or needs an accommodation with your SSD, please let us know as soon as possible so we can make sure that you get that accommodation for the exams and the assignments. Okay, so if you have an SSD situation, please notify Professor McDaniel and myself as soon as possible. Let's see, so the due dates, submissions, SSD, what else we got?
One last thing.
Oh,
In writing your in the news assignments, remember, we're not asking you to take a stance on whether or not something is good or bad or right or wrong. We're asking you, given what we've covered in class, how does this relate? So right now, you're going through the first module, you have the discussion of Schottschneider, you have the discussion of the early parts of the U.S., U.S. Constitution, the Texas Constitution, civil liberties and civil rights. So how do these various things play into these topics? So we don't want a piece about whether you like the squad, you dislike the squad, how you feel about President Trump, or how you feel about third parties, but more, what does this mean given what we've talked about? And so in some ways, we're kind of desensitizing this because we want to talk about this in relation to what does this mean in terms of the rules or how government works, as opposed to what's right or what's wrong. It's more of, okay, well, how does this work within the larger framework of how the government actually operates? And this is critical to what we want you to get out of this class, is that you can watch the news and get opinion, what's right, what's wrong. You can get an idea of who the players are, but we want you to understand what the rules of the game are and understand how these processes work and how they're couching a lot of the things that they're doing within these processes. And by better understanding these processes, you can better understand how government works. I think many people can name key figures, but have no idea what they do, what they can actually do, what their powers are. We want you to be able to understand, okay, Who is this individual? What is their role? Given their role, here's what they can and cannot do. Or given this issue, here's what can and cannot be done. And by better understanding the machine that is American government, you can better understand what outputs you should expect to get. But furthermore, you can be much more engaged to understand, okay, well, how can I get the output that I want? How can I get the policy that I want? And by better understanding how the government works, you can accomplish that.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking that to Professor McDaniel's point, you know, if I'm going through the civil rights lectures that we offer in the first module, and, you know, we talk about different strategies of the civil rights movement. And I was thinking about, the squad, these four freshmen congresswomen who clearly adopted, political action strategy, right? You know, they're not doing nonviolent direct action. They're not doing a legal strategy. They ran for office in an attempt to get power, to influence the system. I mean, how's that working out for them, right? These are the kinds of connections we want you to make to talk about. Federalism, structure of government, the constitutional claims, parties and coalitional tensions, these things will make more sense as you kind of build your knowledge throughout the semester. But, Professor McDaniel and I have talked about this class. This class is like the ultimate safe space, but not the way it's traditionally portrayed, right? A safe space is like where you can go and feel warm and comfortable and not feel threatened. No, we actually, when we say a safe space, we mean we want you to come in and really think about politics, right? But to go beyond the arguments that you have with your neighbors, right? To actually use kind of deeper theoretical understandings of what it means to have a democracy to inform and to give structure and substance to the events of the day. And so to the extent you can do that in the news, like, hey, this made me think about this. And I think it's, that's what we're looking for. You got to be quick. We're not looking for essays, but, just sort of in and out. Observations, things you thought were interesting that you can relate back, from the events of the day to interesting and important concepts. That's what we're looking for. So with that, first one's in the bag. We look forward to our next In the News segment next week. Welcome to the class, and come to office hours when you get a chance to. Contact us. We're happy to talk to you guys, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
The Government 310 In the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.